thanks. It's good to be here. And as I said, I'm at ARS in Athens, Georgia right now, but this work was done in Bowling Green, ARS Bowling Green, Kentucky. And it was partially funded also by the Center for Produce Safety. But I've been asked by my very excellent boss from Bowling Green to announce that my position, research microbiologist position, is open in Bowling Green right now for the next couple of weeks. So if you want to work at a great place on great projects with really the most meticulously prepared technician, then you know, then you should really look into the job. Okay. So again, I don't want to tell this crowd a lot that they already know, but manure associated, so that subset, I guess, of foodborne pathogens are present in animal waste, and they're spread in many ways where waste is spread. They can run off into water, and they can often be, especially I'm looking more from a food safety side, be on animal hides, meat, or eggs also. The industry has really done a fabulous job of coming up with control measures or preventative measures to reduce the incidence of foodborne outbreaks, but they do continue to occur. And the reason the produce safety is so interested is because the economic burden across the industry because of, you know, one bad situation is really huge. And also FSMA, the Food Safety Modernization Act, is prioritizing the preventative measures on pre-harvest side. So you're hearing a lot more about pre-harvest in addition to post-harvest. So this is kind of relevant across the board. And so what the industry needs is biosafety level one surrogates. So indicators, you know, indicate that there may be a risk of a pathogen, but not necessarily the pathogen is there. Surrogates, on the other hand, need to represent that pathogen. So when you're trying to develop control measures, you need that surrogate to behave like the pathogen would. And so they have biosafety level one labs. Many of them have biosafety level two now, but they don't have the personnel or the capabilities. So they need something that they can use to design their better control measures at their facilities. And the problem is that a lot of the surrogate strains, and so we'll call them like quality control strains, things you buy from ATCC that have been sold for lab purposes for years and years, they're recommended by FDA for many of these purposes. And the industry is finding a lot of times these just don't really mimic what's happening with the pathogen. So what we're interested in and is looking at E. coli, a better kind of E. coli as a surrogate. It has a long tradition as an indicator organism, and so it's known by industry and it's known by regulatory. And the methods have been worked out meticulously, they're cheap, and lab personnel know what they are. So there's a lot of advantages to it. One of the things, they've been coming up with some new surrogates, even genetically modified surrogates, and those have to go through FDA regulatory procedures to be approved. E. coli, they know. A problem is, and I think we've heard a little about that, E. coli is not always a good indicator or a good surrogate organism. And I'll just show a couple of studies we've done in the past that, you know, kind of illustrate that. So this is swine slurry at the top 5 to 10 centimeters. And this is time, which I lost somehow. And cells per mil of slurry. This is not culture. This is qPCR. But you can see this is, wherever it is. This is the total cells, Bacteroides, Clostridia, E. coli. You know, so we're talking orders of magnitude lower. So it's something we think about, you hear about, but it's often not a predominant part of the population compared to other things. Another study we did, it was on poultry litter, and kind of like what John was saying earlier, we looked at indicators and pathogens after field application. But we found that our litter had less than, or about 10 to the second cells per gram of litter. That's the litter going in, and ours was fresh out of the house because I needed those things to be there. And then we never, of course, detected it in the field. So, you know, it's not a good representation. So our objective is to identify a better surrogate. So despite all the bad things I just said, the fact is there's a lot of good opportunity there because of what's known, and E. coli has incredible strain diversity. And E. coli does well in the environment, actually. So it's something that, you know, it's not going to just die off immediately when you try to look at what's happening on a lettuce leaf or that kind of thing. And but that again, that surrogate has to behave like the pathogen would, and so survival, adhesion, biofilm formation are the kind of things you're interested in. And so our approach was that we had a library of, you know, over 1,300 E. coli isolates, and we had gotten them from poultry, swine, and dairy manures, and then from surface waters after a prolonged dry spell and a surface water after a prolonged wet rain period. And then we kind of went through an iterative process, as everyone does. It starts out with a lot to get to 200 and then 60, 18, and then 5 isolates we used in a greenhouse study. And so we started out with lab studies of biofilm formation, attachment, and soil attachment. And then we went to some greenhouse studies that I'll talk a little about. So are all E. coli the same? And this may be, again, something I'm telling this crowd that they don't need to hear, but, you know, this is a kind of selective media that shows you a curly formation, which is a protein that's produced, a cellulose fiber, or other types of proteins that are produced that promote adhesion in some cases, some argument about that. But the point is this is 3 poultry isolates right here. So you can see this is difference in, you know, 1 poultry source, a dry weather event E. coli, wet weather event E. coli. This is that QC strain. It's 25922. Probably a lot of people know that organism, E. coli. 0157, that was our representative, and salmonella. So you know, they don't all look the same, and E. coli is not an E. coli, as we know. So we next looked at biofilm formation, just a very simple assay that I ended up liking a lot more than I thought. I just needed to narrow down the isolates. And what we found is that there's a lot of difference based on source of isolation. So this is swine isolates, chicken, dairy, dry and wet weather events, and these are the percent of positive isolates when grown on a very nutrient-rich media, LB, or in lettuce lysates. And the lettuce lysates are basically like you just smash the lettuce up, like, a lot, and then you filter it, and then you add mineral salts media. And so it's lower nutrient. And so you can see there was a lot of difference between different sources. Dairy had very few biofilm formers. And there were also a lot of difference. So we had started all this study with Carl Bolster, who's a hydrologist in Kentucky, and we started with swine isolates, and I loved them, and I was very excited about them in terms of their ability to adhere. But what we found out was that they – let me go down here. So what we found out is if those swine isolates were grown on a very nutrient-rich media, they formed a ton of biofilm. Oh, sorry, LB, the blue. But if they were grown on the low-nutrient media, they didn't. These are our chicken isolates. They formed more biofilm if they were grown on lettuce lysates than they did if they were grown on an LB. And this is pretty cool stuff, I thought. This is the quality control strain, so the 25922, our 0157 representative, which just did not form a lot of biofilm. And this is salmonella, which is a star, right? For grown in high nutrient, very, very low biofilm formation. And then I think it was 10, 20, 30 times more biofilm if it was grown on lettuce lysates. You know, so obviously some differences in the physiology there. Then we looked at a couple of different soils, so a silt loam and a sandy loam soil, so differences in kind of surface structure and organic matter. And we did find these are 3 poultry isolates. Again, you see the major kind of differences in different isolates in the way that they adhere in those soils. A lot more adherence to the silt loam soil, which is expected, than sandy loam. And, you know, even the salmonella and the 0157 were incredibly impressive in those samples. Okay, so the next thing we did was to, so we went all over to lettuce lysates. So we grew our isolates up in the lettuce lysates, and then we looked at the percentage of the cells that adhered to lettuce leaves at exposure for 30 seconds, in just dipped in high concentration of the isolate, the lettuce leaf dipped in the isolate, and then we washed it off and then measured the residual. And so this is the quality control strain, and these aren't huge numbers, but quality control strain 0157, which is very variable actually, and then salmonella, which is our adherer. And then we looked at some of our isolates. So this is water sources. So we had a few that were kind of higher, and then many of them were not impressive biofilm formers or adherers, I should say. Poultry isolates, again, were stars as far as adherence went. And then the swine isolates, again, were not impressive. But you have to say, so here you have your quality control strain, your 0157H7. So in this case, these are behaving more similarly, right? So if for a surrogate, you're not looking at a winner in biofilm formation necessarily, unless you're talking salmonella. For 0157, that wasn't a property that you're really looking for. And so this is when we went to the greenhouse studies. We mimicked spray irrigation contamination by just kind of putting drops of the isolates on leaves, and then we destructively sampled. And so we have the industry, the QC strain in yellow, our 0157 representative, and this is just one of the isolate, a water source isolate. And taken over 24 days, and what you can see is the industry strain behaved, for the most part, similarly to the 0157. Our environmental isolate was a little bit higher in its persistence over time. 0157 dropped out for a day, and then all of a sudden pops back up. Extremely noteworthy that at this 22-day sampling, the environmental strain, the QC strain are gone, and our 0157 pops back up. That was very variable, and it didn't even happen in all their experiments, but, you know, that's key, right? That's our persisters. That may be the tiny portion that you actually worry about. And now when we add salmonella in, you can see that it's quite different than the quality control strain in the way that it survives, but more similar, our environmental isolates are more similar. And we found that kind of consistently. We have several of those that we thought were pretty impressive. Again, you see this drop-off where our controls, our surrogates, our indicators are gone, and we had persistence of our pathogens. It's the huge mystery and pain of microbiology. So, in summary, we have a lot of, the E. coli have a lot of diversity. I like the idea of using environmental sources for this purposes because these are really hardy organisms that have had to persist through the gut-intestinal tract into a treatment system, into an environment. So they're obviously something that is used to sticking around as opposed to something that for the last 30 years has been recultured in a lab. Of course, the key is keeping that diversity as this new organism would be recultured. But it's the idea of being able to really match your characteristics of your surrogate and your pathogen. So the quality control strain was actually not bad in the way that it behaved compared to 0157. We were looking mainly at adherence, but it was not acceptable if you were using that to try to mimic what would be happening with something like salmonella. And so I would just like to thank, and I've got three pictures here. This is Ethan Givens. He's at Western Kentucky University, and he was a master's student, and he was phenomenal. Didn't mind getting in this garb that was tremendously overdressed for the job, but it taught them well. And then this is Rohan Parekh, who is very camera shy, but I have that picture of him. Thank you, and I'll be glad to take questions. The biofilm? The, there's a really simple crystal violet biofilm assay. Yeah, and actually I had no respect for it, and it is highly variable. But the fact is, it has a lot of, well, especially when you look at what happened with salmonella, it's, there's just no, that one's not hard. But yeah, it's. Oh, it's well, like we did 4 or 5 reps just to make sure, like, you know, and it's easy. It's a 96 well. I'll send you the method. It's a very simple method, but it is, you know, there's a reason people use it because it really does, you know, give you some information. Hey, Ed. For 0157, for example, or yeah, no, yeah. So this proposal actually had multiple strains in it. But by the time we had gotten with all of our strain characterization and strain diversity for our E. coli, which is huge, you know, it's a lot to sort through. We didn't even try multiple strains. And that would definitely be a way forward. We are also sequencing some of the isolates that we got, which I like a lot. But, yeah, my guess is there's a lot of diversity, you know.
Because you probably have a window, right?
Yeah.
And maybe what you want is your surrogate to be within.
In the window, right. It's true. And those are kind of different between sources. Right. So our isolates were more produce safeties. Like ours was the predominant salmonella produce safety isolate. But on that point, they have worked this out to some extent, surrogates in the beef industry. And so I'm going to say Gary Acuff at in Texas. But anyway, he actually has it's actually available through ATCC. And what it is a suite of isolates that represent that range for 0157H7. So we're not looking at this isolate for that purpose. We're looking at what are our suite that would best be representative. But I agree.